Day, September 20th, 1980, interviewing Floyd Lowe.
Yeah. Floyd, why don't you tell us the story of the Deutsches Haus again?
Well, the timing was during the war, and I don't know exactly what stage of the war it was, but it was at the time that the Bund was getting real active. I think there was quite a story about the camp they had in New York. Well, we had a German caterer that catered a Bund party at the Deutsches Haus. Now, our union had a very strong rule that extra waitresses were not allowed to book themselves on any jobs. It had to be booked at the union office on all extra work, and that was so that we would have a fair distribution of the available work. Somebody tipped me off that a waitress had booked herself for that, for the night of the big Bund party. I went there, and the first thing that impressed me or came to my eyes was the amount of swastika, large swastika flags hanging over the banisters of the balcony. And I went to this waitress and I said, "Now, get your fanny out of here. You know you didn't, not allowed to book yourself." And she went and talked to somebody for a few minutes. And finally, a couple of these fellows with their armbands with the swastikas on them come over to me and said, "What's our problem here?" And I said, "Well, we got a girl here that's broken a union rule." He says, "Well, let's go upstairs and talk about it." I said, "Well, there's nothing much, not much to talk about." But I did. I stepped up to the top landing with him. He says, "You know why we've brought you up here?" I said, "Well, you said you want to talk about this." He says, "No, we brought you up here so you'd fall farther when you throw your ass out of here." And just then I saw a waitress walk by, and I hollered, "Hey, Elsie, tell the girls that Floyd's in trouble. Do it quick." Well, brother, it did only a matter of minutes, and the whole crew was upstairs watching what went on. And of course, nothing happened because of the crew there, and they saw that we were organized, and they sent the girl home.
Did the women walk with you out?
They went ahead. They went ahead and served the party, but the girl that had booked herself was taken off the floor.
Uh-huh. How about the Four Aces restaurant story?
Well, how big was the crew?
Oh, I think there was 10 waitresses, probably 10 extra waitresses.
And Paul, if you're standing in front of the Deutsches Hall looking at it, is the restaurant on a lower floor or the hall or an upper floor or to the side? Or?
You know, the actual physical layout of that building is escapes me entirely, excepting I know it's a big room.
How many room people would have been at a party this size which would require?
Well, you could say a woman is 10. 200 people, because you figure 20 people to a waitress.
That was the standard ratio?
Just about, yes. Depended on something, a little on the amount of service they were going to require.
You mentioned yesterday that what you told them was that you were going to, you just wanted to tell the girls to go outside to catch it. Was that?
Yeah. I said, they're going to throw me out of the... going to throw me over the out the window here or something, and you girls go downstairs and catch me when they throw me out. But of course, they didn't throw me out. I'm still here. But I don't think the public really knew how active that organization was in this country.
Were there a lot of events?
It surprised me. I didn't realize it.
Were there lots of events and parties that...
At the Deutsches Haus, yes. That the union catered? Oh, we catered parties, hundreds of them all over the...
I mean, for the Bund.
Oh, no. This is the only Bund situation that I run into.
Do you remember Fritz Kuhn?
Well, yeah, Fritz Kuhn was... he was a leader of the Bund, wasn't he? Sure.
Was he at this party?
No, I don't know that. I wouldn't know.
Did you ever have like renegade caterers who would like consistently refuse to cooperate with the union? people who would basically try and set up their own crews without going through the union?
Oh, well, sure. Once we started, after the sit-downs and after we got Clara McLaughlin, who headed the hotel association employment office, or blacklisting place, whatever you want to call it, then, of course, it was a question of mopping up the whole city, getting control of all of the parties. And, of course, that took some time, and some would be a problem for a while until they finally came in.
What was Cora McLaughlin, the woman who ran the hiring agency for the industry before the union? Where was her hiring agency located?
Is there a State Street in downtown?
Yes.
There? I think it was on State Street.
And what was the name of it? Was it
all we ever knew is that it was run by the Hotel Men's Association, and its purpose was to keep away from the union. So they'd call her instead of calling the union for help.
Okay. And what year was it that she was and her whole staff was brought into the union?
I think it was just a matter of a few months after the sit-down strikes. I think that was one of the conditions that the thing was settled on, that they no longer use their outfit, they had to use ours. So they suggested that we take Cora over, and of course we'd been bribing her, trying to bribe her to take her over, and she wouldn't come. But she was a great person, really a nice person. She died of cancer. I kissed her in her bed up there just few days before she died. I went up to see her quite often.
But she came and stayed with the union until the day she died?
That's right. She brought a woman by the name of Ethel, I forget what her last name was, with her. She was her right-hand woman, and she came along, and she was a sweet person, too. And she's dead now. She done a marvelous job, and she handled it. We referred to a lot of these old waitresses as gold star mothers, you know. They're passe as being fancy waitresses somewhere, so finally they go back and work the extra board. Well, if you could get in four or five, six tricks a week on the extra board, you were just as well off as working steady. And some of these girls really did well on the working nothing but extras. We had about 500 at one time that did nothing but work extras, so you can see how extensive the catering was and how well we had covered the field.
So it was basically by seniority and
seniority had nothing to do with the extra line. They tried to see that everybody got a fair share of the available work, okay, as near as possible, rotated, yeah. Okay. Seniority had nothing to do with that, with them.
Was that how Cora ran it before, or was that the way the union ran?
That's the way we run it. I'm not too familiar with just what Cora, how she run things. I know she had an iron hand, and she knew how to handle those girls, and some of them were pretty bitchy, I'll tell you. You know, after they get a little salty after a lot of years.
You call this the extra board? That's what it was called?
The extra crew, yeah. Just call them the extra crew. Still in existence now, but the union and it runs it. They furnished all the country clubs, all the hotels. I don't know of any affairs where they need a large number of waitresses, because you got to have, really, see, they're coming into your place just for one night's work. You can't break somebody in for that type. Well, you got to have somebody that has been there several times, or they're used to breaking into one-night stands, and they become real battle axes, you know. They're rough and tumble. No beauties. They're past that stage. But gosh, some of those women were horses.
So you're saying in Detroit now, like when the Republicans came to town and they needed extra...
All went through the union.
Everything goes through
the union.
There is no non-union.
No non-union hotels or none of that.
We were going to talk about the Four Aces organizing. part of it, you can throw in the Jimmy James angle.
All right. Well, the Four Aces, its proximity was it was in the proximity of the Briggs body manufacturing plant. And I say 95% of all their business was union business. A couple of girls came down and said they wanted the union to come in, so we talked to a few of them, and they decided that they'd walk out. We told them to, and we figured it would be very short, and the walkout would probably end in a matter of an hour or so, which generally happened under similar circumstances. But the fellow that owned it, or the family that owned it, was they called them Buffaloes. I guess that means they're from Belgium. And he made the statement, "I made a million here, and I'll spend it here to beat these bastards." And he paid no attention to it. They just happily, the family hung around the bar and drank, and no customers. And I mean customer number one, excepting one time, one fellow was there talking to him all the time, and finally a waitress decided to go in and slip a Mickey in his drink, and he comes out on the line and holds up the pickets both ways with his hands out and throws up on the sidewalk. But we had a girl there by the name of Virginia who had a friend that was a U.S. rubber worker by the name of Jimmy James. And one day, James, and I didn't know his name at that time, but introduced himself and asked if he could stand there with us on the picket line. We said, "Well, who are you?" And he says, "Well, I'm a rubber worker." And he says, "But my girlfriend works here." He says, "And they've been coming out and slapping pickets and getting cars and leaving." And that actually did happen before that. I said, "Okay, stick around, fellow." And sure enough, one of them came out and gave one of the pickets a push in the face, and Jimmy took off with his car, and story is he broke the guy's arm down the road a block or two, and there was another fight that I think Brother Gazin told you about, where somebody got it in the alley from Jimmy James. And you want me to continue the story about what happened to James after that?
Well, what happened in that strike? How long did it go?
Oh, it went for several weeks. Mm-hmm. And we actually were breaking. There's no doubt about it. Because he wouldn't get customer one. They were three shifts. They used to pack that place three times. Now you come to a weekend. He put on chicken dinners or something, and he packed it on weekends too, with a different crowd entirely. So it was really a jumping place.
How did it finally end?
The contract.
He just caved in.
Oh yes, he caved in. That's the history of Detroit up to the time that Myra come into the picture. We'd never lost a strike in the history of Detroit. Never lost a battle, excepting the one was Fisher, and that was only temporary. There was a break there of several months. But up till that time, we started losing them under Myra.
Is there any one thing that helped break this particular strike of Four Aces, or it was just over time they couldn't take it anymore and they caved in?
Oh, it got a little rough with the Mickey Finn. Somebody went in.
So I went into a Mickey Finn. You've used that three or four times.
This concoction was made up by a waiter. He lived on Front Street in Philadelphia. It swept the whole country. And I was out with cousins one night, and he said, and he was with the Times. And he says, "Floyd, is it true that these waiters all carry Mickeys?" I says, "Yes, a first-class waiter will have a Mickey in his pocket." He says, will you go out? Can you go out tonight? Can we go out and make the rounds with you? And you prove this to me? I said, sure, if it'll be off the record. I said, I don't want any publicity on something like this. He said, all right, Floyd, you know me. I said, okay. So we stopped at the motor bar first, and I called the waiter over, and I said, and the waiter said, who, this guy? I said, no, I don't want one in my hand. So the waiter went out and come back, and he give me the Mickey. So I said, you want to sample it? Go ahead. It's a Mickey. They were in little pieces of paper that were folded and refolded, and probably about that long, but it's just a powder that you open the paper and out. It's generally served best in something hot, but it can go in your beer. Can go in food. It doesn't make no difference where you put it. It was a harmless thing. You shouldn't confuse the old-time Mickey with the knockout drops that prostitutes use. There's just no comparison at all. They are dangerous. A Mickey is not. It's just like a physic for a horse. If both ends fire at the same time, you miss the bathroom by two steps. You throw up and bang, bang, you know. And my first experience really with a Mickey was when I was working as a waiter in the Silver Slipper back during the Depression down in Florida. And the boss holds a meeting. And he says, now you got to sell Indian Hill ginger ale because they're helping us get open. If they want Canada Dry or anything like that, just tell them, well, we haven't got any that's cold or it hasn't come in yet. It's going to be in tomorrow's load. Give them some excuse, but all they can get is that ginger ale. And do the same. They did name several other things that you just had to push those things because that's the way some of those businesses at that time got open. If they didn't get a little bit from this supplier and that supplier, they couldn't even open. Then he's in the meeting, he said, now if you need a Mickey, you get it from Tom the Checker. He says, we don't want any rough stuff here. He says, if anybody gets really out of line, he says, I don't want you to misuse these now, but if you need a Mickey, get it from Tom the Checker. Well, one big bruiser started getting real loud at a party one night, and he was ordering the waiter around, getting nasty, and finally they decided he was a customer, you know. And I watched the operation. He's real noisy, real big shot, and all of a sudden he slowed down just a bit. He wasn't such a big shot anymore. Getting up close to him, all of a sudden a little white streaks the side of his mouth, and all of a sudden he starts looking around the room, and all of a sudden, zoom, and he missed it. We had to clean up the mess, you know. She hit good. But I had a cute one at the bar. See, they had a bar right there in the lawyer's building at one time. It was a blind pig, really. The waiters had a bar there. And two waitresses, one of them was Mary Eaton. She's dead now. And I don't know who the other one was. They're sitting at the bar one night, and of course they were rounders, and they had Mickeys. And they decided, well, wonder what a Mickey tastes like. And they says, well, let's taste one. No, I don't want to. Well, let's split one. Well, if there's anything worse than a Mickey, it's a half a Mickey. Now, half a Mickey, it's just painful, that's all. Now, they didn't have a toilet up there, but they did have a thing about that high in a little mop room where they wrung their mops out. So, finally, I don't feel anything to you. No, I don't feel anything to you. Back and forth. Yeah, I think I feel something. How you just think you're feeling? No, I feel something. So they go over there and they try to throw up in that thing, and then finally they try to get their butt up there. They had to get way up like that with their butt. They just cracking, the joints cracking up, you know, because they can't even close that door, really, for that mop thing. Here's two waitresses splitting the Mickey. Everybody cracked up on that. They split the Mickey. They wanted to know what it tastes like.
So
they're tasteless.
You mostly used it to control customers.
Well, another way to get one, for a woman to get one, if she says you tip the waiter too much or you tip the waitress too much and takes part of the tip back, she's a customer the next time she comes in. Okay. Or somebody that wants to stiff the waiter entirely the second time, he might be a customer.
Is this just a
couple? Or a bartender, if you go in and he gets real busy and order Puss Cafe, you might be a customer. You know, a Puss Cafe is. Mm-hmm. A Puss Cafe is a glass, it's a pony, tall glass, that you pour the liqueurs according to weight, carefully pour them, so that when you get it, you got different colors all lined up perfectly. Now, they got to be damn good imported liqueurs, because their weights are true on those. Some of ours aren't true enough so to use, because they diffuse, you know. But you order a Puss Cafe because that takes time to make one. They got the soup making for a whole banquet. And they'd throw whiskey bottles in the toilets so they wouldn't flush.
Where is this?
This is in the Jefferson Hotel in St. Louis. They'd threw the white waiters out and put a colored crew in. Started a revolution. A fellow by the name of Conrad Schott was the head of the union at that time. I guess they locked up half of the union leaders in St. Louis at the time. The story I get.
We were going to ask you to talk about the role of black waiters in the industry and then in the union.
Well, all three of our locals were lily white up to the time of the sit-down strikes. And, of course, they all the people in these different hotels after the sit-down strikes started coming to the locals to fill out their applications and become members, because a lot of them hadn't done it up prior to the strike. But this, when they came to the window of 705, when black maids started showing up, they were sent to the building service union. I think it was located on Woodward Avenue. And this went on for, a short time. I don't know just how long a period this happened, but I know I watched it happen to quite a few different colored people. Finally, the story got to Ed Flory in Cincinnati, and he came into Detroit and says, hey, these people are supposed to be in our union. He says, we're not a white union. And heck, there's evidence of that is that in that book you'll see at our first convention, I think there was two Negroes. I think they were from the sleeping car porters or something on the executive board or in some position. So he ordered that we go after these, get these people back. No, that was quite a thing. We really had to raid the union that we sent them to get them back. It was quite a headache for a long time, but we finally got them all back.
Said that it was the lily white union up until the sit downs in 1937.
Yeah.
But there was the case at the Detroit Athletic Club where black waiters had been organized into the union by Max Gazin.
No. Max Gazin started organizing them after the sit down strikes. And Max Gazin was the one that went before the executive board and said, you better take these people in. If you don't, you should remember what happened, how they got there in the first place, back in 22 or 23. At that time, they were white waiters were organized back during the pig days. And they walked out, and colored walked in. Max reminded them of that, and says, you either take these people up with you or they'll take you down with them.
Jackson said he had tried to begin to organize.
Yeah, that's right.
That's why he got fired there in
36. 36? I think he's mistaken on, I think Max is mistaken on his dates. Because, well, yeah, we may, listen, Max could be right, because we were, I don't know how Max, what he intended to do with them, how he was going to, because at that time, we were Lily White, and I don't think we'd had the joint board fights yet. He could be right, because I was organizing Waiters Like Mad, the white ones, and he could have been doing the same thing there, that I couldn't pin that down myself from my knowledge. But I do think he's a little confused on his timing or his dating.
Except that in this case, he seemed to remember pretty well, because he remembered his trip to the West Coast very vividly.
Yeah.
And then when late 36.
He could be right.
He could have been starting.
He could have been starting. And that was his thinking. I'll tell you, Max's thinking was, you better take these people in. Mm-hmm. But that was a hell of an argument on our joint board. And Max stood up. And boy, I give him a lot of credit, because to stand up at that time, on the colored issue, huh?
Would that be in the minutes of the joint board?
Yeah, I don't know if they would be available or not. A lot of this wrangling at a joint board didn't get in minutes.
Right, and all in the motions.
No, just in motions. They were free-for-alls, and what made it really a bad setup was the fact that you could, if you got into a real tight bind, we'd vote per capita tax. By that I mean the union that had the most members. You cast your vote according, just like in a stock, in a company, you know, you vote your stock. But we would vote our members. Well, the members of 705 could outvote the other two locals. So you're really in charge. If it comes right down to a hot fight of any kind, Koenig used to say, I vote per capita tax, and pull out the, and shut off the lights, and walk out. Of course, that made for the bad feeling between our three locals, and that existed for years, always fighting. That's the only smart thing that this Hanley did, was to put the three locals back together, but got them back together, and now Myra's got them split up into seven different branches.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody attends meetings anymore.
So this DAC strike was then in 37 or 38 was...
Yeah.
Was when the union was finally recognized.
Yeah.
Detroit Athletic.
Yes.
Club.
Yes.
Okay.
Now that strike was quite a story. Right away they started getting help from a employment agency on Hamilton, I think it was. And they were taking carload after carload. That place was packed with colored people, black people, and they were taking them down there and giving them jobs.
At the DAC?
DAC,
during
during a strike. Because we see them coming and ask one of the, call one of the workers, when he found out there was a picket line, he came off the side and said he wasn't going to go in. There was labor trouble there. And we asked him where he come from, and he told us the employment agency. So Art Stringary, Lou Walters, myself, and I think Cecil Watts got in a car, and we went over there with ball bats. We walked inside, and those chairs were lined up with people just like in a church. And when we swung that first ball back and pulled the telephones out of the wall, you should have seen those people. They were straight up in the air and out. They didn't even seem to tip their chairs over. I don't know how they got out of there so fast. And I think we threw our ball bats through the window and left. But we got outside, the car wouldn't start. And here, pretty soon, we could hear the old siren coming, you know. Finally, it started. But they could see us taking off. And as we're keeping ahead of them a little bit, going into the downtown, turning corners, we decided to get out one at a time, so that there was no use of all of us being locked up. Let's have somebody out to get us out. So it ended up with just Lou Walters and I left in the car. Stringary got away, and I guess Watson, I think there was a fifth man there. We get into the police station, and we had some friends at the police station at that time that got their Christmas presents regular. We did the same thing the bosses used to do. We took care of certain friendly people in pretty good shape. So when we get in trouble with they generally always come around with a friendly, "What's the trouble here?" And we had to stall for time because we couldn't find anybody. So Lou Walters, they asked him if he was French. Or no, they asked him what his nationality was. He says, "I think I'm French." And then they ask a couple more questions, and he said, "Just a minute. We're stalling for time. I'm a little far removed from, but I can hear what's going on." And he says, "No, I think I'm German." "No, damn it, I think I'm French." Back and forth, and he stalled for just enough time. We see a policeman to, "Hey, go down and clean our car up. It's got some ball bats in it." And they did, and find out if there's any witnesses. And there was one woman that said, "Yeah, I know the guys. I saw it happen. I know who they were. I could identify them." So they told her, "You know, those are nice guys. They got jobs." "Oh, they got jobs? Yeah, they can get you a job anytime." So she says, well, if they can get me a job. And so she didn't, when we got into court, she didn't know us.
A policeman had told her this?
Yeah. When we got in court, she didn't know us at all. "No, I never saw him before in my life." So we did get her a job too, I think. Quite
sure. How long did that strike go on?
Oh, I think 4 or 5 days at the most.
And it was really...
Probably it was a little more than that, because there was one central body meeting where it came up and was discussed quite freely. I think it went on almost 2 weeks, because they hired Hoods to protect the hotel, to protect the DAC. Some of these same Hoods that the Ford Motor Company had, you know, and they loaded the place down. And when it was evident that they was going to settle, a couple of these Hoods came to us and said, "Hey, you want us to smash something up?" They wanted us to get them, put them on the payroll too. It's some of the same mob that manned the book Cadillac, you know, with their guns and everything. They'd hired quite a gang of those in the DAC.
When was that strike?
Well, it's got to follow the hotels by some time.
Max said 1938.
That would be about right. It'd be about right. But
who owned the DSC?
That's a club.
So it was owned by the membership?
Membership, yeah.
And it was really the richest people in the city.
That's right. That's where Knudsen, you know, one of the stories got out that Max used to cook for Knudsen, but now he's cooking for Knudsen's workers.
Now, who went out in that strike? The waiters?
Everybody.
Cooks?
Everybody. It was one of those mob psychology things, you know, where they come out. Very few people stayed in.
How many people were there?
Oh, I would estimate a couple hundred. Maybe not quite that many.
They had rooms too, right?
Yeah.
For visiting businessmen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's been union since.
Oh, yes.
And the black workers participated in the strike?
Oh, yes, very active.
And Max said yesterday, because he had known them and tried organizing them a couple of years before.
Were there any particular black waiters who you recall as being active in that strike or immediately afterwards?
I think we hired one of them. I think his name was Gaston.
First name or?
No.
That was the last name?
Gaston was the last name. His name is Gaston. Then we hired, later on, we hired a fellow by the name of St. Louis Geach, and he was a nut. But we decided to organize Hastings Street. You know, those were black and tan. Most of them were owned by Hoods. So I was supposed to meet him one day in one of the black places. And I went in and took a stool and ordered a drink. Of course, I was the only snowbird in there, white person in there. And finally, a big, burly black man came up to me and said, "Hey, I'd like to have that chair you're sitting on." Started to turn around like that. But that minute, St. Louis Geach walks in the door. And he saw him starting to argue. Hey, he says, "Leave him alone. He's hot as a pistol." I'm hot as a pistol. I turned around, walked away. But he was a real con man.
What was his name?
St. Louis Geach, they called him. But he talked several languages, and we had to finally get rid of him because he was strictly a con man.
That Louis Geach.
Yeah.
While we're kind of talking about the kind of tactics you were forced to use, yesterday we were talking informally, and you put it in perspective really well about why that kind of level of violence was necessary. I was just wondering if you could kind of
I think this follows all of our history, or the world's history for that matter. I don't think there's any social game, religion, or any real positive situation we got down through history that there wasn't an association of some violence with it. Even you mentioned religion. My God, look at the violence connected with it. Labor's first battles had to be violence because it was nothing but violence used against them. So what if you get violence against you, what do? You go to the law of the jungles. You become violent as a matter of protecting yourself. Labor was in that position until, I think down until Murphy, really, that's Justice Murphy, made the ruling that picketing was legal. Up until that time, we had all kinds of state laws that picketing was not legal. Michigan, the Beck case, and I forget what different cases, just made us all criminals. Well, you're criminals, you act like a criminal. You have no choice. That's Dave Beck. Dave Beck organized the Northwest. When? There was no David Bacon Act, no wage and hour control, no NLRB. Who protected labor? The boss had the police departments, well paid off, well heeled and directed. And what did labor had? All they had was to finally fight back. And they didn't give a damn how they fought back. Neither did I. Occasion called for a stick of dynamite, well, you used it. We had a crew out on Grand River where the boss found out they joined the union. He gave Mickey's to his whole crew. Well, boy, I never saw Kenny get so goddamn mad in his life. But the next day, the dynamite blew the damn door out while he was in there. And he stood in the doorway of the store. He said, "Come back here, you sons of bitches, and do that again." Yeah.
So when do you think the need for that ended?
I think that it ended gradually. You see, Hoffa learned under Beck. It didn't end with Hoffa. Beck started hiring public relations men when he started getting the laws and getting protection. He started hiring. Jimmy never threw the ball bat away. When the Joy had trouble with the Joy gas stations, somehow or other, somebody synchronized their watches and the dynamites went off and all of them at the same time. There were some stories connected with that. I don't know whether it's true or not, that they actually wanted the company out of business. I don't know. It sounds like the way they operated on them. But then he started hiring hoods on top of it. Well, you would hire a hood, but you never fire him.
When did he begin hiring hoods?
Well, they mentioned this... what's his name, Peroni? Peron, yeah. That was about the first time that I knew he had a relationship. I think some of it got into sex life or some, I don't know, some stories on that. Some girl was involved. Have you read the wars, what do they call them?
The Hoffa Wars, yeah.
The Hoffa Wars?
There was a woman that Hoffa was hanging out with, and yeah. Later... They split up, and she ended up hanging out with a gangster whose name I can't really remember.
Yeah.
It might have been a Peron, and that was sort of the link.
I can ruin any employer now without any violence at all. If I can get good stories from the inside, and I became a notary public, and I took these stories down, brother, I got them out on a piece of paper. And I started standing in front of the place and say, "Here's what's happening inside this place." Now, it's informational picketing. If they pick on one of our people while they're trying to organize, I can put a picket line on And I'm protected, informational picketing. I can't make any demands on the employer, because if his his income is in excess of $250,000 a year, he can demand an election to see if his employees want it or not. In the meantime, they get busy with real, they've really got this thing down to a science of brainwashing. The employer's really got the attorneys and the firms now that can take a crew and just really brainwash. I've had crews so completely organized that if I tell them, like I say, move this place across the street, they would, only to let it go through the several months and give the lawyers with their techniques to come in and brainwash. We had one down in Florida just 2 years ago. I helped the local while I was on vacation down there, called the Sea Wolf. Out of, I think, 100 and some employees, they got 14 votes. And the one time they were so mad, you know, I mean, just fighting mad. I mean, OSHA went in there and God damn, they just had to tear that place apart just to be able to operate because of the rotten things that were going on. One toilet for all of these people. People were pissing in the back and around the corner, and it was really a hellhole.
Do you think it makes more sense for them to maybe strike in those conditions and then?
I tried to get, that's my idea. I says we should strike, to hell with it. And Jesus, Paul McCaslin, one of the vice presidents, called me and says, God damn it, Floyd, you're not in Detroit now. And I wasn't getting a nickel. I'm doing this on my vacation, helping this poor son of a bitch down there. Because he's starving too. The local's poor. And I'm giving them a hand. I says, the only thing to do is while you've got these people, get them outside. And once they've committed themselves outside, then let's move them back in, then call it a lockout if they don't want to take them back. I did that at the, yes?
Yeah,